Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 comics sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we'll be talking about in this episode are the top 300 comic sales through Diamond to retailers for January 2019. Now, joining me on this episode is Sam. How you doing tonight, Sam?
Good. How are you, John?
I'm doing pretty good. Now, Eric was unable to make it this month, so we're not going to have that retailer perspective, which, of course, is sorely missed. But We're gonna go through the numbers as they usually are. Sums up, sums down. Actually, more was up than down this time. If you look at it from a month to month perspective, the aggregate of the top 300 was actually up a little over 500,000 units. It always amazes me that it can do that sometimes, even though most of the titles that stick around have gone down. But that's the miracle of new titles. If we look at how the top 300 is broken down. 45.44% of it went to Marvel in terms of the units of the top 300. 37.24% went to DC. And that actually spreads a little wider if you look at it by the retail dollars for those same items, with 46.14% going to Marvel of the retail dollars and 37.05% to DC. Really, there's not that much of a difference there, and it really came down to actually the average price at DC was a little higher and stuff. And really, sometimes we see a big difference when we go looking at it by units or by dollars, but this time between Marvel and DC, not that big of a deal.
It hasn't changed much since DC kind of gave up on the $2.99.
Yeah, I think that was a lot of it right there with DC having an average price point that was cheaper, that made the spread a bit wider. And now that they've kind of gone away from that, you're right, it definitely evens out the playing field in that regard.
And not only have they gone away from that, they've kind of gone with Marvel doing the overpriced issues more commonly as well.
Overpriced is a loaded term, but I know exactly what you mean. I think a case could be made all of them are overpriced. But
fair enough. The $4.99 and plus issues, they used to have almost none of those.
Yeah, they're doing a lot more of that kind of stuff. I think Marvel's gone hog wild with it at times. But yeah, DC's following suit. And I mean, you can't blame them for doing that, because all the stuff that we as readers sometimes complain about of the higher prices, the variant covers, the frequent shipping, the constant number ones, are all practices Marvel thrives at, and it really hasn't hurt them at all.
That is correct.
I mean, they're typically the top publisher in the top 300, and often by a significant margin. So if those things are working, they're not going to stop it, and you've got to expect other publishers to adopt those practices as much as it might be in the long-term disinterest of the industry.
Yep.
So, if we look at Image, they were in third place with 6.72% of the units, 6.35% of the dollars. So, distant third. And let's see, then we had IDW with 2.72% of the units in the top 300, 2.83% of the dollars. Dark Horse not too far behind with 2.26% of the units, then Boom with 1.47% of the units, and then Dynamite with 1.38% of the units in the top 300. And if we add those up, we basically see just how much the premier publishers just dominate the top 300 sales with 97.23% of those units.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not the least bit surprising, because most of these other publishers are publishing, you know, a handful of items, and they just don't have the market penetration that the bigger publishers have.
Yeah, no, they certainly don't.
If we turn this in, or go ahead.
I was going to say, it was a particularly bad month for Image. That being true, both kind of by dollars and percent, while it is kind of lower than typical, it's right on par with where they were kind of last December, January. So this just seems to be a bad part of the year for them.
Well, and Q1 is often, you know, not gangbusters in terms of sales and stuff. January in particular gets the brunt of that. And I think it really comes down to who comes out with what material when. And DC kind of pushed a lot of things that would have been at the tail end of last year into January.
Yeah, but it's not like DC's numbers indicate they got an extra week out of this. I mean, they're kind of where they always are.
True, true. But I think that was part of why we saw a little bit more lacklusterness in December. And if you were to kind of take these 2 months, they'd be kind of where they would have been in the December, January, a year back, except some of it would have fallen a little more into December than this time a little more into January, I think.
Yeah, that's probably true.
But, you know, you look at these numbers and, you know, the other premier publishers beyond DC and Marvel, yeah, they don't have kind of a huge percentage. They've got, you know, 14.55% of the units for the top 300. And, I mean, other than Marvel and DC, these are the quote-unquote big boys, you know? It's just a lopsided playing field.
Yeah. And again, when you look at units, the 430,000 is, I believe, yeah, is Image's lowest since they had 419 last January. And, you know, again, that percentage is also 6.7 is their lowest, really, since they had 5.8 last December. So yeah, it's just a bad part of the year for them for some reason.
Yeah, I think part of it is they've got a number of titles that are kind of on hiatus, you know, with like Saga and stuff like that. And then part of it is just, again, luck of the draw. They've got so many new titles coming out every month that if they hit a batch that just doesn't hit as big, that's part of it. And I think also some of it was, even if you have a bunch of number ones that hit big, how do those number twos do?
Yeah.
Because there were some sharp drops on some second issues this month. We've got a number of other publishers on the list, but really they contribute so little to the overall amount that looking at the breakdown of them is almost a pointless endeavor. But when you get beyond the top 300, and again, we've got the full top 500, and if we had visibility below that, they would have more sales. But, of course, those sales are at a lower level, so even if they had lots of titles, and let's face it, some of them don't, it takes a little longer for those things to add up.
Well, and once you get out of the premier publishers, you're only talking a total of 26 units, and not a single one really selling above the 20,000 mark.
Yeah. I think part of it is, it's a rough market out there just in terms of reader expectations and satisfaction. And also, it's a very crowded market. You know, yeah. I think Marvel in particular, they had, you know, 100 items out this month, most of which were new items.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's helping anybody, including Marvel. Shall we jump into the top list itself?
Sure.
Now, our top item was also, I'm pretty sure it was the top item in December. It was, Batman Who Laughs. This time we've got the second issue, 116,827 units. That dropped over half. And even here, I think it's unsustainable and is likely to drop significantly further. Yes, it may be a hot character or whatnot, but it's just, these numbers, generally speaking, aren't viable.
Yes. That being said, the 50% drop, obviously, it is what it is. But again, how many books get to that 230,000+ we saw last month? Not many. I'm not as convinced this necessarily has to drop a whole lot more.
I'm not saying it has to drop a whole lot more. I'm saying it'll drop noticeably more. It'll get probably below the 100,000 mark within the next issue or two. And it really depends how long is this thing lasting.
Well, yeah, I don't disagree with that, but with the way we've seen Batman dropping and the, you know, somewhat general dislike of how that title's going, it could kind of become the top Batman title, which could leave it near the 100,000 range.
Okay, that's fair. I hadn't thought about that perspective. I was thinking more of kind of the quasi but not quite event aspect of it. But Scott Snyder on a Batman book versus Tom King on the Batman book definitely, I think, could factor in. You're right.
And you've also got the artist, you know, as well.
True. Jock is very popular.
Yeah.
Definitely has a strong following. So, and part of it comes down to, I didn't look into how many variants they had on the first versus the second and stuff like that.
We did talk about this last month. There was only, as I remember, three variants on the first, and they were all open to order. There was, because I specifically asked.
That's right.
That crazy 230,000+, you know, what kind of shenanigans? And Eric went, nope, there's three, and they were all open to order.
Yeah, DC's a lot less likely to do the cover shenanigans than Marvel is.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate.
Which should bring us to the next three items, and I can't wait to hear this list of variants.
Well, let's see. We've got Captain Marvel number one. This is the female Marvel version, not the original Captain Marvel, which was the one you shouted Shazam. Although both are having movies come out soon. It did 111,391 units. And to suggest this is not sustainable is, I think, hopefully unnecessary, both because few titles at this level are, and this property in particular tends to gravitate towards the 20 to 30,000 range, rarely being above that over the last 15 years. In this case, it had a 2 1-in-10s, a 1-in-25, a 1-in-50, and a 1-in-100 variant. So heavy, but not crazy heavy as Marvel can do.
Yep.
But this is one that I expect to be, you know, dropping substantially, even with the movie coming out and stuff like that. It'll be half the sales on the second issue, which I'm pretty sure is not in this month. I don't think it's
no,
in,
yeah. The only one that's in this month is Conan.
Okay. Yeah, I've got that below. But yeah, Captain Marvel number two will be roughly half this. By the time it's at issue six, it'll be probably, I'm thinking, close to the 30,000 range, if not much sooner than that. It's just, as much as Marvel keeps promoting this character, it's not that strong of a character.
Yeah, let's keep going, and then we can kind of talk about, you know, all the four of these, because I do think there is something here to be said.
Oh, yeah. All right, next up is Guardians of the Galaxy at rank number three. It's the first issue there with 104,916 units. And let's see, it's got, I don't know, about a dozen variants. It's got the regular cover, a 1-in-50 artist variant, a meter exceed 250% of Venom number 5 for a blank variant. They've got an order all you want of a limb variant. Let's see, three other meter exceed 250% of Venom number 5 to get those variants. A wraparound variant that you can order all you want of. And a 1-in-25 variant, a 1-in-10 variant, and actually yet another meter exceed 250% of Venom number 5.
Yeah.
So the meter exceed of Venom number 5, they had, what, half a dozen of.
Yeah.
This was
a fairly strong book, as I remember.
I believe so. It just seems like that's almost a little bit of an arbitrary kind of, you know, title to pick. And that Venom number 5 sold 69,365 units, all said and done.
Yeah, so again, a top 20 book. And 250% of that's kind of a very high bar to me.
Yes, yes. And why that book? You know what I mean? It. I don't know.
Yeah.
If they had done it on Cosmic Ghost Rider, who's at least in Guardians of the Galaxy, it's like, okay, I could see that. I wouldn't necessarily agree with it, but I could see it. And then the next item on the list, which falls into this category of crazy number ones at Marvel, Conan the Barbarian number one, 100,963 units, and it had a plethora of variants. Let's see, a 1-in-10, a 1-in-25, a 1-in-50, a 1-in-500, and four or more meter exceed 250% of Avengers number 9 for this, and a few open to order variants.
Yep.
So, again, Marvel is heavily promoting first issues with these incentive covers, and it gets them near the top of the list for the first issue, but then, and Conan's a great example of it, because we have the second issue down here at rank 46, which was 37,906 units, that's a drop of over 62%, 62.46%.
Yep.
So, are they selling the title, no, they're selling the cover on the first issue and getting those copies sold, but it's got no carryover to speak of.
No.
I get why they do this, but I question the long-term effectiveness of this.
Yeah, no, I agree. And Conan's a perfect example. Why don't you skip down to number 10 at Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man number 1 as well.
Okay, we've got that at 78,021 units. And it had, let's see, a 1 in 10, an open-to-order Art Germ variant, a 1 in 100 Art Germ Virgin variant, a 1 in 25, a 1 in 50, a 1 in 10, and then two that are meet or exceed 150% of Amazing Spider-Man number 7.
Yep. And that one, the number 2, is also on this list at rank 63 at 32,432, down 58.43%, losing over 45,500 units. All told, there are 8 Marvel number 2s on this list. They average a decrease of 44.2%, and the vast majority of that being that low a number is propped up by the fact that the Man Without Fear number 2, which sold 28,000, was only fighting from 33 and only lost 13.8%. You take that book out, the average goes up over 50%.
I would definitely take that book out because Man Without Fear was a weekly book.
Yeah.
So that's playing by, I think, fairly different rules.
Yeah. So, yeah, again, you're talking about, you know, and, you know, it appears to be just an acceptable part of the business model at this point. But Marvel's, you know, second issues, you just expect them to drop around 50%.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Marvel's strategy for a bit because they rotate titles frequently. I mean, all of these, sure, they're number ones, but we're going to have them, for the most part, probably recycle into a new volume or replacement title of some sort within the next year or two, guaranteed. Conan yep. being the possible exception to that, just because that's what they do. And they're going to load up that first issue with variants and stuff. They're going to do pretty well. But that rotation of titles really came in full swing this month. Because when I listed through in my article the defunct titles, like the top easily two-thirds of that list in terms of starting with the most units removed from the list because the title is gone, they were all Marvel. Now, part of it was Infinity Wars had wrapped up, Spider-Geddon had wrapped up, X-Men Extermination had wrapped up. This also included the Defenders Best Defense quasi-miniseries. But then there was The Life of Captain Marvel, X-Men Red, Peter Parker's Spectacular Spider-Man, Old Man Hawkeye, Spider-Girl, Spider-Force, some of the other Infinity War cross or, you know, secondary miniseries, Champions, Weapon X and stuff. They just had a huge amount of sales taken off their board, and they've got to work to replace those sales. And sure, we can account for a fair amount of them right here just with these couple of number ones.
Yeah, exactly.
But we can also cut those sales in half on the number twos.
Yeah, but if you just eliminate, you know, I don't know, call it five, you know. And again, Marvel, when we talk about how many things they put out, you know, we had 97 new items. If you eliminate a 20th of your list every month, that's basically 5 new number ones that you can do this with every month, which will replace the 5 that drop off every month.
If it were 5 things that dropped off, that's fine, but they lost nearly 800,000 units to titles that ended.
Yep.
So they've got to transition those readers onto other titles, and they don't always do that.
No, absolutely. But again, just, you know, kind of to keep it in perspective, those 4 books we just talked about, Captain Marvel, Guardians of the Galaxy, Conan, and Friendly Neighborhood, replaced almost 400,000, about 395,000 of those missing units. Just 4 of them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's, again, part of how Marvel seems to stay steady. But the problem is they have to keep launching high.
Yep.
And they've shown they can do that. But if we are in a speculative bubble and these variant covers cease to be effective, this strategy stops working instantly.
Oh, yeah.
It just seems like a very dangerous one because we've yet to see many titles get up to this level and then kind of stay there.
Yep.
There are the occasional ones that do okay, but again, I've said this zillions of times before and we'll say it zillions of times again. I think they should sell on content, not on cover.
Yes.
But everybody agrees, I think, conceptually, but man, doing the covers, it's an easy way to get money.
Yep.
So, rank number 5, we've got Amazing Spider-Man number 14, 91,697 units. That's actually up 38%.
I was going to ask, can you account for that? Or is it just a book people like?
I think part of it is it's a book that's doing well. They had a open to order. They've got an open to order one and a meet or exceed 100% of Amazing Spider-Man number 11 to get another Conan variant. We've got a few other titles that are bouncing up, and I'm wondering if it's the Conan themed covers. Because I think some of them have that. I'm not sure. There didn't seem to be anything in particular in that issue story-wise that would account for that kind of a jump, and rarely does a story point lead to that kind of a jump, unless it's a introduction of a highly, you know, anticipated character or the death of a character.
Yep.
But that brings us to Batman, and it had two issues. Number 62 did 90,634 units, and then 63 dropped 7.7% down to 83,659 units.
Yep.
So this goes back to Tom King is just not the sales juggernaut on Batman that Scott Snyder had been. Which, again, not terribly surprising because, again, that run of Batman is a really hard thing to replicate, I think.
Yes, but yeah, it's, yeah. And again, completely anecdotal and clearly from an older demographic. I know lots of long, long, long-term Batman fans that just are kind of have dropped this book.
Yeah.
You know, people with hundreds and hundreds of issues consecutively.
Well, and think about the damage that does, because you can't get much more loyal of a reader than that of somebody who's literally been around for hundreds and hundreds of issues. And they're saying, well, not for me. I mean, it's hard to get them back on board.
Yeah.
Hey.
That being said, things like Batman Who Laughs, the Batman Damned, I know a lot of those same people like the White Knight. There's enough ancillary Batman stuff that I think you're keeping many of them somewhat around.
You're keeping them around in the hobby, but you're not keeping them on the title.
Yes.
And I think
but you're keeping them on a Batman book.
True, true. And that's better than not. But if Batman is essentially your flagship title, you think you'd want to keep them on there. Because if you've got people who are saying, no, I'll just wait for the miniseries that looks good, that's a more fickle audience than I'm going to get the main title month in, month out.
Yeah.
And let's face it, there have been some times in the past couple hundred issues of Batman in the main title where it hadn't been great.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people, you know, stayed through there because, it's a dry spell, whatever. But I think it's actively turning some people off right now.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Then after that, we got the two issues of Heroes in Crisis. Number 4 did 82,151 units. That's down a little over 6%. Number 5 was down another 3.75% almost, down to 79,087 units. Again, not making a huge splash with that title in terms of... It's supposed to be a big event title, but I'm not hearing a whole lot of people talking about it, and when they do, not favorably.
But it's in the top 10.
True.
I mean, it's not like it's, you know... That we've seen other quasi events or like you used to call regional incidents that didn't crack the top 10 or anywhere near these numbers.
This, though, has a lot of the hallmarks of an actual event other than the apathy. Because it's impacting a lot of characters.
Yes.
So I just think it was an ill-conceived story.
Yeah, fair enough.
We've already talked about Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man. And then just below the top 10, we've got the relaunch of Young Justice, which did 73,952 units, which I thought was a fun title. So I'm curious to see how that does. I do expect it to drop well below that, just because I don't think these characters can sustain sales at that level, you know, even with Bendis on the writing.
Oh, and I was looking for higher numbered issues, not the other way. Rank 13 is actually Amazing Spider-Man 13 at 66, 396, which was down 11%. So I guess that, I mean, 14, there has to be something about, whether it was an anniversary issue or covers or something,
I'm thinking covers.
something special happened, whatever. Clearly that is not where Amazing Spider-Man, which has been doing better and been in or close to the top 10 recently, that 91,000's not kind of where it really tends to be.
Yeah, if we look at the sales history, it is, generally speaking, been, well, the whole run's been dropping. Staying, it had been around the mid 80,000s for a bit, and then was dropping well below that. And then it bounced up both on issue 10 and here on 14.
Well, like you said, 13 was down to 66,000. So,
Yeah, that's starting to get close to half where, well, actually, that's, I was gonna say half where the title started, but I hadn't scrolled down far enough. I was looking at number two. The second issue of this title had done 121,000 plus, but the first issue had done, all said and done, close to 300,000.
yes.
And that's with a $5.99 cover price. So they made some money there. They can afford, I think, for the title to dwindle to what, almost a fifth or a sixth of what it started at. But that's the kind of drop off that's really hard to take if you didn't start at, astronomical levels.
Then you've got the Justice League books for the month at 15 and, or Justice League number 15 and 16 at ranks 14 and 15. One just above 60,000, one just below 60,000.
Yeah.
So again, steady, kind of, that's kind of where they are, not where they started, but not plummeting exactly either anymore.
Yeah. Well, we're seeing detectives starting to kick up a little bit as it's doing the countdown to 1,000.
Yeah.
Those are selling in the neighborhood of 52,000 units, give or take.
Oh. Then you've got Venom number 10. I wonder if this split a month or something. This is clearly the kind of bottom of where Venom's been in this run. A book we talked about quite a bit a few months back. But that was a book that, had a huge launch in the 200,000s. But then, a couple at 80, and then it kind of leveled off at 60, and then would pop up into the 70s and 80s occasionally. Number 7 did 90, number 8 did 80, and then you kind of get that big drop again.
What I think happened with this one is it started crazy high. It did the expected, I don't say course correction, but slashing, because okay, people want the first issues and the variants, whatever. Got to that low point of 4. That's when people realized, hey, this is actually pretty good. It started picking up a bit, and then maybe the market overcorrected or whatever. It got a little high and stuff over at number 7, and that's when it's been falling back again. It's almost like it had, I don't say two honeymoon periods, but it's definitely an anomaly in how it's selling.
Yeah, and this issue happens to be, not that this is unusual, we can say this about almost every book, but in this particular case, it's unusual to say it's its lowest selling, and clearly so, of the run.
Yeah. To me, what's unusual about it is not the initial drop, but that bounce afterwards. As it's trying to find its level, and I think retailers may be kind of chasing this up and down depending on the interest.
Yeah.
And no doubt the variant covers on these issues is making that even harder.
Yep. Return of Wolverine number 4 seems to have found its level just below 60,000. You say you have something to add to that?
Not really.
Okay.
I'm behind on my reading on that. It's doing a, you know, it. It did the expected huge drop on the first issue, a noticeable drop on the, between the second and third, and then, yeah, the slow decline after that. I think it's only a 5-issue miniseries, though, so.
Yeah. And one we talked about a few months ago, and we had a long discussion last month about, or yeah, last month, about how much value creators add. Rank 18, which is still really good. Green Lantern, number 3 at 54,003, but again, down another almost 17% from the 65. So while Grant Morrison certainly has a fan base, it's not a crazy high level, even on a semi-popular character. and he's not Batman
or Superman or Wonder Woman or Flash or Aquaman or. But yeah.
Well, I'd argue Green Lantern, particularly when he's done well, is in the Flash, Aquaman.
Certainly in the comics arena, he's one of the A-list DC characters. No question about that. You start talking to people outside of that, they're going to immediately recall, if anything, the movie that didn't do well. But, I mean, this title is selling under half where it started just a few months ago.
Yes.
So it's a pretty quick drop. And you've got a top name writer on it. That's not a good combination. But I'm sure they've got enough in the pipeline that it's just going to play out for a bit.
And as you mentioned, the detectives, all three of them are here, and it's kind of steadily climbing as it races towards 1,000, which I believe, as we record, this is already out.
Is it?
Hey, is it or?
I was not thinking it was, but I'm so far behind on my reading, I honestly couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
Because 997 came out on January 30th. Yeah, we're enough behind on this, and you might be right.
It's really close. I want to say I saw it. It might have been. No, it will be out as we record this. It'll be out in about 3 weeks from today.
Okay, that sounds more reasonable, because I would have thought James and I would have said, maybe we should review that.
Yeah.
Of course, that means I should catch up on my reading. I actually had somebody email me, geez, maybe a couple of weeks, a month ago now. I still haven't gotten back to him. I'm so far behind on my email. Asking what I was thinking of these issues. And had I replied, I basically would have said, I think I haven't read them yet. But I was afraid that might come off a little snarky, which was not my intent.
Yeah.
Once I get around to reading those emails, I'll try to remember to reply to that listener. I feel bad about that.
And again, that is a $10 book coming in at just under 100 pages.
Yeah. That's a good reason not to review it. That's a lot to read.
That is a lot to read.
We probably will review it, though, but yeah. What else do we have here? We've got some issues of Uncanny X-Men. We've got Superman. Again, all of this is selling right around the 50,000 unit mark.
Well, as we talked about creators last time. Here we are again. Action Comics together ranked 31 and 32 at 46,140 for 1,006. And that's down 6%. And then 1,007 down an additional 3.75% to 44,405. This is a book that by 1,010 could easily be below 40,000.
Well, it's hard to say because they're starting up that Leviathan storyline. And James and I reviewed actually 1,008, which was the second part of that storyline. And based on what I'm seeing in previews, it's looking like this is going to be a pretty big deal. I don't know if that's going to help the sales of Action or not, but it could.
Okay, fair enough. I guess that hasn't come out yet, because I don't think I'm behind. I don't remember that review.
No, we just recorded that two nights ago as we record this, so I haven't posted it yet.
Listeners will probably have heard it by the time this goes up, but yeah.
Yes, they should. Matter of fact, they may have heard it a week or two back by the time this goes up. Let's see. What else do we have? We've got Shazam number 2. It did 43,607 units. That's down 37.41%. That's a pretty harsh drop for a DC book, second issue.
Yeah, again, the key there is for a DC book. Compared to some of those Marvel number 2s we just talked about averaging in the 50s, that's not that bad.
No, not at all. But DC also doesn't tend to load up their first issues with a dozen variants.
That is true.
We're starting to get, at this point, the Age of X-Men Alpha number 1, 42,022 units, some other X-Men books, and now we're starting to get a couple of the Star Wars books down here, too. And they've really cooled off from where they were at one point, where they would be selling significantly higher on the list.
Yes, that is true. And I know Eric mentioned it last month, how well Immortal Hulk was doing. We've got those two issues here, too. Well, there is kind of that crazy spike at number 10 last month. We've got two more issues here that are not only a drop from the spike on number 10, but basically continue the trajectory it was on, you know, kind of 6, 7, 8. You know, if you look at kind of where it was trending before that spike at issue 10, it's kind of right back there.
Yeah, it's actually been relatively stable, staying within the 40,000 to 50,000 range after that second issue.
Yeah, but it's dry. I mean, it's 48, 46, 47.
It's trending down generally, but not too badly.
Well, but these are the first two issues below 41, which it was approaching before it bumped up to 44 with issue 10.
Yeah.
And you've got the Flash books, which are kind of in a similar situation.
And we had three of them this month.
Yes. Yes, we did. Oddly enough, well, not oddly, they are in the order you'd expect. The first of, yeah.
First to come out sold the best, then the next best, then the next best, yeah.
Yeah. That's issue 61 to 63, which was at 40,000. 596 for 61, which was down almost 2,000 units from the previous one. And by 63, it's all the way down at 38,263, down a little more than 2,000 units from the one at the beginning of the month.
Yeah, it's generally trending down. It did have a period around May through August of last year where it was kind of bouncing up a bit. And I forget which storyline was going on at that point. But then after that kind of couple issues, that's when it just started trending back down again. And it's got the occasional blip where it bounces up.
Well, and those are usually the Batman crossovers, aren't they?
Sounds about right. When did the button happen? Was that 2017, 2018?
I think it was late 17. It might have been early 17, but I were 18, but I don't think so.
Yeah, I'd have to go look that up. But it's one that's following a fairly steady trend, and if anything, it does seem to, the decline seems to be accelerating.
Yeah. Rank 48. Why don't you take rank 48, because this is an interesting one.
This is Invaders number one. James and I recently reviewed the second issue of this, but this first issue did 36,462 units, which for a launch of a Marvel book, not gangbusters. And if it's one of those that, you know, heaven forbid it follows the same trend that we've been seeing on a lot of these things where it drops in half, that would be really catastrophic. Don't think that'll happen, but, you know, it did have, let's see, four meter exceed 150% of Avengers number 9. It had a 1 in 25 cover and a 1 in 300 cover. So it does seem to have a good chance of falling noticeably if the second issue variants are not as good of a promotion, which is almost guaranteed, because they're unlikely to have a 1 in 300 on a number 2.
Yeah, well, and that just, yeah, the Invaders are not any of the Avengers and like we were talking about earlier.
Well, ironically, one of them is because it's Captain America.
That is true.
But it's got Namor as essentially the bad guy, and it's got the Human Torch acting more like a writer-reporter than a hero. As a matter of fact, he never flames on. So it's not really the team of invaders that one would expect from the name of the title. That's what I think will really hurt the book.
Yeah, probably.
And it kind of feels a little like a bait and switch.
And just for clarity's sake, I did check. The button goes all the way back to April and May of 2017.
That's what I was thinking. Those are the ones that really spiked up really high.
Yeah.
But then right after it was pretty much even with, if only a hair above where it was right before that.
Yeah, and I read those in trade, which came out in late 2017, October, November-ish. So that's why I was thinking it was at the end of the year or possibly the beginning of the pre-next.
Do you have in front of you what was happening around June, July of 2018 in The Flash?
I do not.
Because that's where it was noticeably above where it was. I'm trying to think if that was The Flash War or something like that. It seems a little early for that, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is kind of what it is. But yeah, it's, you know, what issue numbers are we talking, by the way, for that?
The chart I'm looking at doesn't have the issue numbers. Let me dive over to where I would have that. That would be, oh, it'd be right around 49, 50, 51. So yeah, it would be around the Flash War then.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And it looked like they were going one way with that, and then Heroes in Crisis hit, and they clearly went a very different direction.
Yeah.
What else do we have in here that looks interesting? We're right around the point where we hit Buffy the Vampire Slayer at rank 70. It did 31,043 units. Not bad, not brilliant. And we're also at the point where we've got the five issues of Man Without Fear, the first of which did 32,237 units. This is the first of a five-week weekly series, kind of, I think, bridging the gap of the Daredevil's title that ended and the Daredevil title that will pick up in the February sales. And then, for the most part, every issue dropped with a bit of an uptick of about 0.35 of a percent on the fifth issue, which may just be either a variant cover or people wanting to know kind of how it ended.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, these kinds of weekly miniseries don't do particularly well. I think a lot of people see it as a sign of a lack of faith in it when they rush it out like that, because everything's solicited before anybody sees anything.
And we're well past it now, but I do, if you don't mind, want to go back to rank 30.
Okay.
A book we talked about long for quite a while, and when it was constantly in kind of the top 10 or just near it, and could it stay there, could it compete with Batman? Walking Dead, the last year or so, has been on a significant downturn. We have issue 187 here at 46,536. Still rank 30, still very strong. But clearly the lowest selling that title has been in 4 or 5 years.
I'd say probably 7 years. I think it's early 2012. And it's funny because around April of that year, it had just a noticeable uptick of about 20,000 units. And that was before it had the first of a couple of issues that just spiked in the hundreds of thousands of units area. But yeah, this is just kind of sort of falling off a cliff here.
Yeah, particularly if you kind of look at the history over the last, I don't know, 6-8 months.
Yeah. Well, and even if you go further back, if you look starting around September of 2016, for the most part, you've got a solid downward trend. What's weird is normally the exceptions would be issues that kind of spiked above, but this has a couple where it'll go down for a few issues, spike up, down a little, spike up, down a little, spike up, and then it goes down that downward trend that we're seeing more recently.
Well, yeah, if you take the spikes, which, you know, tend to be, you know, places like 168, 171, 175, where it kind of spikes over 80,000, mm-hmm. The trajectory after that still kind of keeps that underlying trajectory minus the spike.
Yeah, that's what's weird, is it's got the same vector. It's just there's a couple of units that are at one level and a couple that are about, you know, 10,000 above that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what's up with that.
But yeah, I mean, this is the first time it's been below 50,000. Well, in the easily accessible to me anyways chart going back to, like you said, September of 2016.
Yeah. Well, what I did is I've got this other spreadsheet where I can do just a quick visual chart of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it had that slow upward trend starting back in 2003 up through, again, April-ish 2012, had a bit of a noticeable uptick when it really started to be climbing substantially, you know, in 1 month, and then climbing upwards ever since. Well, actually, let me rephrase. It was on an upward trajectory for about another year or so. Then it went down a little and was hovering between the 70, around the 70,000 range for really most of the next 3-4 years, with a couple of exceptional issues, the 100 and stuff like that, that spiked just crazy high. And then in 2016, it arced up, peaked at around a little over 100,000, and then it's been kind of drifting down again, with the exception of those handful of issues, you know, half dozen, of course, over 2017 that were just, you know, noticeably lower than the rest. But then, yeah, here it drops off sharply, you know, 11,000 plus unit drop.
But again, not uncommon for the last year or so. It's kind of been headed that way.
I would say really that trend goes back to mid 2016.
Fair enough. Yeah, you just didn't notice it because it was still kind of over 70,000.
Yeah, it wasn't as noticeable. And again, in 2017, we've got some ups and downs that if you look at it in a short enough time period, it looks like it's going up.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, I've just kind of filtered out Marvel and DC, and I'm looking at this. It's still the top-selling non-Marvel DC book. It's still in the top 30. It's still over 40,000 units. But again, we're not having those conversations about, is it a permanent fixture in the top 10 anymore?
No, we're not. I think it's not only cooling off specifically, I think we're seeing a definite cooling off of many image titles, and it's heading in the wrong direction, personally. It's going down.
Which brings me to the one I love to continue talking about. Mr. McFarlane keeps plugging away. You've got The Walking Dead, you've got Buffy the Vampire Slayer number one. We didn't mention it at rank 85. We have Stranger Things number four, down another 8% to 26,000. But they're at rank 88, Spawn 293, continuing its recovery that it's seen, kind of the inverse of what we've seen with The Walking Dead the last year or so.
Yeah, it's funny because at one point I was comparing the two with when would they cross, because Walking Dead was overtaking Spawn that was declining. But now we're seeing a very different picture in the inverse direction.
Yeah.
Where it's conceivable, possibly even in 2019, if things are heading in the direction they've been heading of late, that Spawn could overtake Walking Dead.
I don't expect that to happen permanently in 2019.
I'm not saying permanently. I'm saying it could do it shy of just a one issue.
It will. Yeah, well, I can say the 300. One issue. 300. When it gets to 300 and Walking Dead's in the low 190s, it'll probably spike over it.
Yeah. I just think if McFarlane can keep Spawn growing and Kirkman can't keep Walking Dead from shrinking, you know, again, the way the lines are headed, they may cross.
Yeah.
And I think right now, one of the things that works against The Walking Dead is it's got a TV show that if people really want to partake of the story, they could do it that way.
The TV show has also been in a noticeable decline the last several years.
Yeah.
At least as far as viewers go, I don't watch the show, so I'm not talking about quality. And as far as the book goes, I don't think the quality has gone down much. I'm actually still quite enjoying I'm enjoying it more now than I was, I don't know, 50 issues ago.
I like it. I think it's a little slow, which is an odd thing to say for a Kirkman book, because usually he's pretty quick with it.
Yep.
But this whole stuff with the Commonwealth or whatever, it's been going on for a while.
Yeah, yes, it has. But yeah, I mean, it's odd to think, you know, after the decade plus that it's been, Spawn is still one of the top two Image books.
Yeah. Well, one of the top five non-Marvel DC books.
Yes.
So it's, you know, McFarlane's continues to plug away at it, and I respect that.
And with the exception of
Savage Dragon from Larson.
Well, no, I wasn't going to say that. What I was going to say is it is also the second best-selling non-licensed, non-top two book.
Good point.
I mean, you've got Buffy, you've got Stranger Things, you've got Firefly, you've got Rick and Morty, you've got Fight Club. You got to get all the way down to below rank 100 in Oblivion Song before you get an original comic property again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, the licensed properties, if you can get the license for an affordable amount, it's going to bring an audience, and it certainly lowers risk of putting a comic out.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, if you're not one of the big two, I mean, you're clearly kind of seeing that. I mean, just, you know, we just read that's basically all books between rank, you know, 70 and 100.
Well, it's funny because it seems like if you're a creator or publisher with a property you own, you want to get it turned into a movie or TV show. And then the next thing, you know, the other direction to go is if you want to do a comic or whatever, you go license a movie, a TV show or whatever, and do a comic on that. There's actually been one or two times where that circle has come full circle and continued. And I think it was with Hellboy that started as a comic, became a movie, had a cartoon or something based on the movie, a comic based on the cartoon that then became something else. I mean, literally, it went full circle. It was crazy.
Well, and with a whole different discussion, and it's currently on this list, but it has been within the last year, and my guess is it probably will be again. We watched Wynonna Earp kind of make that first circle again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it started out Beau Smith and his little miniseries here and there, and then you got the television show, and then they brought it back over at IDW, and the show is, I don't want to say canceled because that's not quite right, but it's on some kind of a permanent hiatus, which is a whole different issue having to do with IDW Studios and their funding. It's not that the network doesn't want more as much as they don't seem to be able to produce more.
That's a bad situation to be in. Is somebody wants to buy what you got, you just can't afford to make it to sell it to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of IDW and licensed properties, if we jump down to rank 210, we've got Star Trek The Q Conflict, which is actually crossing over the main four branches of the franchise, 9,047 units. I mean, I've said before, it feels like there ought to be more Star Trek fans out there than this, and I think there are, but I don't think the Star Trek comics are selling as well as maybe they could.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Speaking of licensed properties, let's go back up to one I know you love to talk about. I mean, still hanging in there. Rank 153, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, number 35. I would assume you're still at least buying the book. Are you still enjoying it?
I'm still enjoying it. I am a few issues behind on both Mighty Morphin and Go-Go Power Rangers. I think I'm maybe two issues behind on each. I'm liking Go-Go Power Rangers a little bit more than Mighty Morphin right now. Mighty Morphin's a cross-team thing. Imagine the concept for Star Trek Voyagers applied to the Power Rangers. They're lost in space, a mishmash of crews, and they're trying to just survive. That's an okay concept, but not really what I'm wanting out of the franchise. I don't think this is anywhere near as strong as the Shattergrid storyline that led up to it, but I thought that was an exceptionally strong storyline. They are at least playing around with the different teams and doing some fun stuff there. And with Go-Go Power Rangers, it's set back in the Mighty Morphin days, and they're charting some new territory there that's kind of fun.
Cool.
I'm hoping that IDW, or not IDW, Boom, who's got the license now, is able to retain it, even though IDW has most of the license for Hasbro stuff. Now that Hasbro owns Power Rangers, I hope they don't feel obligated to shift it.
Yeah, which as a fan of several Hasbro properties going back decades, I don't want to say it's been mismanaged, but IDW's made some interesting choices with those properties in the last couple of years.
They made some choices that didn't work for me. I was getting a number of those titles, Captain Action, Micronauts, I think, and a few others. And when they mixed and matched them, it's like, I don't want Transformers in with my, you know, Captain Action or whatever. I want a spy story there, you know?
Yeah, and me as the biggest of those two properties, probably in the comics medium, G.I. Joe and Transformers guy, I was kind of okay with them. I was kind of like, I don't want these other properties. And then when they kind of blew up the whole universe, and they're relaunching Transformers, fortunately, they have left Real American Hero Joe alone. Mm-hmm. But the various incarnations of the IDW G.I. Joe are being possibly relaunched again. I'm not 100% sure that's coming back.
That was one where going for the shared universe, I think, was really detrimental to the books they had.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you.
Because it's not just, let's share this universe. And that could have worked. Because if you'd just done miniseries where they cross over and stuff, people could turn a blind eye to that if they felt they needed to. But when you're actually changing up who's in which book on a regular basis, and, you know, Rom is now teaming up with whomever or whatever, it mixed and matched them too heavy and created really a blended universe in a way that purists of the individual properties didn't seem to appreciate.
Well, I don't even know if it was purists as much as they were almost different genres. And therefore, whenever you mixed, you felt like you were getting a different genre.
Well, it became a mashup instead of what it was.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, I think that's the better way to say it, because it's not like I feel like I'm a particular purist for any of these things, but when you've got, and don't get me wrong, I'm a fan of giant robots in the right venue, but when you've got them teaming up with other stuff where it feels like, well, geez, that kind of makes that super spy feel a little irrelevant when he's going up against things that can transform into, you know, fighter jets or something.
Exactly.
Oh, and there's this alien ROM guy who's got these ray guns or what, you know, it just doesn't mix well. It can, but it felt a little more forced and didn't feel natural for these things.
And since we're down here, kind of at this part of the list, ranks 171 and 177, Outcast and Die, 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 those are both Robert Kirkman properties, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Outcast, issue 38 at 10,562, not semi-stable, still dropping, but not crazily, but certainly not burning up the charts below, you know, rank 171. And Die, 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 for a book that got so much fanfare when it got launched, issue 7 at rank 177 at 10,400. And this book will probably be below 10,000 units next month.
It's a bit of an odd duck just because of the skipping of the pre-order cycle. And I'm not sure how much of the sales here are accurately reflecting how many shipped there or not. I don't know.
Yeah. And again, I actually love the idea of the skipping of the pre-order cycle. That being said, apparently most of the industry did not, and nor did the fans.
I dropped off after, I think, the second issue, just because it was a nuisance to figure out when it was coming out and to have it, you know, added to my order.
Yeah.
It required a responsiveness that I just didn't have. What's interesting is both Die, Die, Die and Outcast are landing at roughly the same spot, give or take, and Outcast started well over 70,000 back in 2014, and it's been just kind of drifting down ever since, faster earlier, slower, a little slower more recently. But man, it didn't take Die, Die, Die long to get from the 38,000-ish units or whatever it started at down to, you know, the 11,000-ish units.
Yeah, well, not even. I mean, it's 10-4.
Yeah. So it's one of those things that we're looking at essentially not pre-order sales. That's not wrong. Not right. We used to have pre-order sales. We're getting final invoiced amounts for what the stores actually buy. But because it's circumventing the pre-order nature of the industry, I think they were being conservative here. And again, the first couple of issues just thump, here it is.
Yeah.
So I think it was an interesting experiment. I respect him for trying it, but we don't even have all the sales data because issues 1 and 4, I don't think, showed up on the list. So we've got 2, 3, 5, 6, and 7.
1 wasn't even invoiced, right?
I am not sure how it was, if it was invoiced or not. My understanding, and again, we'd need somebody like Eric who would actually have seen one of the invoices because he's got a store to know for sure. My understanding is it was shipped and invoiced but fully returnable and done at the same amounts that Oblivion Song launched at.
I didn't remember what it was, but yeah, it was just, yeah, it was shipped in some multiple of some other book.
I was thinking it was the same numbers as, or it was based on, maybe it wasn't the same numbers. I'm not sure.
One's a multiple, but yes.
So's half. You know, so's two. Half.
Yeah, exactly. No, absolutely. But yeah, it was shipped based on some number, based on some other book's orders.
Yeah, and it was Oblivion Song that it was done as. And again, I think Kirkman had an interesting idea. I think it's ironic that he was the one that felt the need to do this whole surprise thing, given how vague he tends to be in his solicits. But there is an aspect where I think the length of the pre-order cycle is working against the industry in many respects. But I don't know how they could really tighten that up practically and smoothly to have a better turnaround and get to where we as readers have time to get the book, read the book, and feed the information back for the retailer to order accurately the next issue.
Well, and again, I love the idea of avoiding kind of the pre-orders. And as you know, I've never personally been in favor of it. And I know, you know, when I first started listening to this very podcast, you know, 10 years ago or whatever it was, there was kind of always the ad, you know, those of us that pre-order make up, you know, a small fraction of the real audience. I don't know how true that is anymore. I'm not sure it was true then, but I'm convinced it's almost, I don't know, how many books truly are just bought off the racks these days?
I think very few.
And it'd be interesting to hear what Eric's opinion is because, you know, we were talking even last, and he talked about how many books, you know, yeah, we order for subs and, well, maybe I'll get one for the shot, you know, and, but there's so many books he talks, yeah, we just order what we have orders for.
I think it comes down to the nature of a store because we've heard people like Eric, you look at the writings of Brian Hibb and stuff, and there are a lot of books, it's like, yep, we order what we have subscribers for and that's it, or one or two for the rack or whatever, and it may sit there, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But I know of a store here in Austin, Texas, Austin Books, and it's been around for 30, 40 years. That's changed ownership a time or two, but they don't do subs. Everything technically that they sell is, you know, rack copies. But I think that's an unusual business model these days.
Yeah.
And even stores that have that, I'm willing to bet if I were to go to them and convince them to answer the question, but, you know, okay, how many people do you have that you think you're going to sell this copy to, this title to, or whatever? I would imagine between their clerks, they would be able to come up with a pretty decent guess as to how many people are going to walk in, you know, on average and pick up, you know, be it X-Men or Justice League or Batman or Walking Dead or whatever. In other words, I think they have a good enough sense of their customers to know what to order.
I absolutely agree with that. But I do still think that is fundamentally different than actual pre-orders.
Absolutely.
You know, hey, I know Bob, he comes in every Wednesday and buys, you know, all the X books. It's very different, you know, than having, you know, someone who, you know, actually orders the books ahead of time.
Yeah, it's one thing to say, I've noticed so-and-so comes in and tends to get this, versus so-and-so came in and told me to order this for him.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very different dynamic. But I think, particularly in the early days of the podcast, it was a matter of were some of the few that are pre-ordering via mail order and stuff like that. I think a lot of people had subs back then, but not to the amount they've got now or the percentage of maybe the overall industry of readers, you know, that we've got now. And I think back then, 10 years ago plus, there were a lot more things that would have gotten a copy or two to the rack just as a regular business practice. Whereas now, the back issue market is generally, unless you're explicitly in the back issue market, hanging on to a copy or two of everything you put on the rack to put in your back issue bins is a losing proposition that most stores just don't do it, don't want to do it.
Yeah.
So if you don't know you've got the sale, it is foolish in many cases to get the copy on the hopes that you'll sell it, because that could have killed whatever profit you would have made on every other copy you sold, particularly for titles you're selling a handful of copies of.
Well, and I think even, you know, besides the people that have gone mail order, et cetera, the, and I've noticed this in, you know, kind of the two shops I'm in regularly. You know, 10, 15 years ago, a sub meant, I buy this book, pull it for me. And there was, you know, a piece of, you know, in those days, many cases, there was still a, you know, a spiral bound notebook they kept, wrote the customer's name at the top of the page and listed the book, you know, and they'd scratch, I don't want that. Okay, we'll scratch that one out or whatever.
Or a photocopied thing that you just marked down, check this kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But now, I mean, all, you know, all of those shops have now, you know, I first remember coming across previews, I don't know, 10, 15 years, no more than that, probably 15 to 20 years ago. And the owner of one of the shops I was in regularly kind of said, hey, if you're a subscriber, that's great. By the way, if you want to order ahead of time out of this book, we'll give you an extra discount.
Mm-hmm.
And even, but that was kind of the abnormal, and it wasn't kind of the standard. You know, someone walked in and said, hey, I like Batman. Can you make sure I get it every week? They'd go back to the, okay, what's your name? Write that on the list. Okay. But now, I'm not sure that style list exists, at least not nearly to the percent it used to. That used to be 99% of the pull lists in the country. And I wonder how many of those pull lists now are more, yeah, we got a previews order form for that customer.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm curious about that too. It's a great question. One of the things I did a while back was I put together an Excel spreadsheet that basically did some really rough math on, you know, if you've got something that's, say, a $3.99 comic, and, you know, how many, basically supply-demand kind of a chart to figure out where's the sweet spot, where if you got exactly the number of copies in your supply that there was a demand for, what would you make on that book versus how much money could you have been leaving on the table because the demand outstripped the supply, and how much would you lose if your supply outstripped the demand? And it was a fairly narrow band where even just having an extra copy could wipe out your profit pretty quickly on a lot of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a slim margin that these stores are operating on. And That's part of why, you know, for the last decade plus, I've been suggesting if your store has a pull list, it benefits you to benefit the store by filling it out and doing it, if it makes sense for you. Yeah. They'll be in better shape financially and therefore still around if they're not wasting their money buying stuff that nobody wants to buy.
But like I said, you know, as someone, you know, I had pull lists for years. I had no problem with saying, hey, you know, these are the 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, whatever number of books it was at the time that I was buying, and say, just, you know, pull those for me. I'll pick them up next week, whatever they come out. Like I said, that type of pull list doesn't exist anymore. And really reading previews and picking into it is more hassle, at least for me as a customer, that I want to deal with.
I can totally understand that. A large part of why I had been getting as much as I had, it was simpler to do that than to figure out, well, what title do I want to jump on or off of?
Yeah.
So, and I am a creature of habit, that's part of it. But there's not the concept of the guaranteed sale on some of these books that there used to be of, well, it's a Marvel book, it will sell X amount just because it's a Marvel book.
Yeah.
Or a DC book or an Image book or, you know, whichever publisher.
And again, I don't blame the stores at all, but I part of it's on the publishing strategy as well. I mean, again, go back to those old days. My pull list for, you know, when I first started reading, I was like 7 years old and I had a few bucks a week, whatever, an allowance. My pull list for the first 5 to 6 years of my comic reading was Batman, G.I. Joe, Amazing Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
That was simple. It was easy. It didn't require anything special out of me or the reseller. You can't do that anymore with the way they go through titles. And
yeah, the rotating titles kills that.
Yeah.
I was surprised recently, I think it was when we last talked, to find out that, or confirm that Peter Parker's Spectacular Spider-Man had ended and was de facto replaced by a Friendly Neighborhood.
Yep.
I didn't realize that. I didn't make that transition. They lost a reader. You know, that's not good for them. It's fine for me.
And it's amazing, again, just how things change. I just recently reread Crisis on Infinite Earths, and I was reading the deluxe hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the intro, Marv Wolfman wrote a couple-page introduction, and one of the things he talks about was his kind of idea for a miniseries. And I guess he originally pitched an idea for a miniseries basically with a character like the Monitor back in the 70s, and I believe he said he'd pitched kind of the idea to both Marvel and DC. And both of them kind of said, yeah, miniseries don't sell. People don't buy number ones. They trust something that's got a 200-300 on it.
Yeah.
It's amazing how different that is today.
I remember when Superman Presents the Krypton Chronicles first came out. It was a 3-issue miniseries. I believe it may have been the first miniseries that was explicitly done with, we're going to come out with a first, a second, a third issue, and then it will end. It's supposed to end at issue 3, guys. Be ready for this. And it was a fun story, you know, but it was such a different time that when Brave and the Bold ended and got replaced by Batman and the Outsiders, that was like the first new launch of a Batman book since, well, really, I think maybe ever, because he had taken over, well, since Batman, because he'd taken over Detective and he'd taken over Brave and the Bold.
And that's the other thing you don't see anymore. Remember when they used to change titles rather than renumber?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The contents within a title.
Yeah, but Incredible Hulk was what? Journey into Mystery? Or no, that was Thor.
It was Tales of Suspense? No, one of them. I forget which.
Well, the point is, rather than putting out a Hulk number one, which Marvel wants to do every couple of years now, they went, no, we're going to keep that 152 on whatever it was and just change it and call it the Hulk.
Well, Captain America went for multiple decades without a first issue, and then in the span of one decade got like 8.
Yeah.
Maybe more. I've lost count.
And again, but the number one sell. So again, I guess it's a chicken or the egg. How much of that's the retail, the publishers, and how much of it's the consumers?
I think it's neither. I don't think it's number one sell. I think the number ones appear to sell because, particularly at Marvel, the variant covers.
Yes, but that being said, we've noticed how books don't go up, and even if you're dealing with small publishers and the number one kind of sets the high watermark the title can even do without variants or, you know, again, even when you're dealing with small publishers or, you know, mom and pop shops, they're only doing one book. Books don't go up. You know, it used to be, hey, I trust that. So I want something that's got staying power and proven itself. Whereas now it's, I don't want to miss the beginning.
Yeah, but even number ones often aren't the beginning.
Which
I guess,
is a different issue.
Absolutely. Definitely. It's just, when did the paradigm not just change, but like flat out reverse?
Yeah.
And I think the publishers and creators have trained readers to not jump on anywhere but a number one, because the stories are often inaccessible, incomplete, or, you know, incoherent at times even. And if you jump off a title at any point, I think it's kind of a, well, they're gone. To get them back, we have to relaunch the book. Anytime you get a creative shift, you get a new number one typically. You know, and again, that's so different than, well, you know, this book's not doing too well, so we're going to take this person out and flip them for something else. That's why you had titles that were not named after the character, but you had Adventure Comics, Tales of Suspense, Journey into Mystery, something that was thematic versus a particular property.
Yep.
That's just such a different mindset than we've got these days, that it's like the pendulum has just swung so far to the other extreme from where it had started and where it had gotten.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it would take to either course correct or do something else. I think part of it comes down, in my mind, to story content. You know, if you can't jump on at any point and people are waiting, well, I've got to wait for the next, you know, for the ride to stop and then to let new passengers on, you're limiting your audience right there.
But the easily archivable media, whether it be books, television, movies, whatever, I think has led to that. Oh, I got to get into, you know, when we were kids, how many of us watched television shows that we didn't necessarily watch from the beginning? I know as a kid, one of my all-time favorite shows was The Dukes of Hazzard. Again, A-Team, whatever. You can pick a myriad of those 80s shows. I remember as a child, definitely Friday night, The Dukes of Hazzard was on. I don't remember if or not. I remember when I bought the DVDs years later in my early 30s. I'm not sure I ever saw the first episode.
Well, but I think that goes back to long-form story versus short-form story, and those were all episodic.
Well, but my point is, today, I tell a friend of mine, hey, I really like this TV show. You should watch it. Do they go, hey, cool, I'll watch it on Tuesday when it's on? No, no. They go, oh, which streaming service is on? I got to go back to the first episode.
Well, because most stories these days on TV or whatever have that long narrative, and you're lost if you don't start at the beginning. You know, if you think about it, the story for almost any Dukes of Hazzard episode follows the same basic plot.
Oh, absolutely.
They're good old boys. Boss Hogg's doing something. They get messed up in it, and they've got to, you know, pull everything together and have a couple of car chases for good measure.
Of course.
You know, for the A-Team, they get hired. They've got to go in and you know, right whatever wrong is being done to these local people and such. You know, build a tank along the way.
I'm a fairly mechanical, hands-on kind of guy. I do not weld. I don't own a welding rig. That being said, all my buddies, all my friends, I've been locked in a lot of garage, or not locked in. I've been in a lot of garages and sheds in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I know of one that's got a welding rig in it. Somehow, whichever random barn the A-Team got locked in, there was a welding rig. I never figured out how that worked.
Well, that part of the country, you know, I have no idea. Well, and there's always the parts they need to build that makeshift tank.
Yeah, of course.
At the end of the episode, that's done.
Yeah.
You know, you would have some overarching things like Decker chasing after him or, you know, whatever. But these days, most stories, certainly in comics, certainly in television, even in movies, that there's progression from installment to installment that is as important or often much, much more important than the individual installment. Comics used to be that you would read a 17 to 22 page story that had a beginning, a middle, and an end. Maybe it had a cliffhanger and you'd pick up on a second half later or whatever. But it was not, I'm going to tell you, a small 3 or 4 scene clip of this bigger story.
Yeah. But is it because of the easily accessible, cheap media? It has got, and when I say cheap, again, relatively, not that I'm saying comics or any of this stuff is cheap. You know, My wife, for instance, huge Indiana Jones fan. First time she became aware of Indiana Jones was when she was, you know, a preteen, tween, or possibly just like 13, 14, when Last Crusade came out.
Mm-hmm.
And her and her cousin walked to the Cineplex, and they went, yeah, let's try this. And they saw it, and she loved it. And then, you know, she had to wait 4 or 5 years till Raiders showed up on TV, and then a few years more for VA. Now, even myself, when Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was coming out, first thing I did was go, oh, let me go grab my DVDs. Let's go watch all three of them before we go see the new one. That wasn't an option back then.
Well, absolutely. And that's why I think as kids, we had to watch so much stuff midstream, is because that's what was on.
Yeah.
But you're right. These days, if we want to go start almost any story, be it comic, movie, TV, novel, whatever, we can do it from the beginning.
Yeah.
And often we almost feel punished if we don't.
Yeah.
Because, again, of the inaccessibility of the story at times.
Yeah. But like I said, it's, yeah, even if you get out of the comics and you do get complete stories and all that, it's amazing how many types of media it's true of. Yeah. There have always been detective, you know, I read mysteries. There have always been detective series. But again, James Bond, I'm a huge James Bond fan. I watched those films in the random order they came out or happened to appear on television. I picked up the novels as I happened to run across them and use bookstores.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But I think it's a different storytelling structure.
Yeah.
Because last night, as we record this, my sister and I watched the first two episodes of Whiskey Cavalier.
Oh, I got to watch the second one. I watched the first one myself yesterday.
They're episodic. I mean, for the most part, it's they go, they do their thing, and end of story, end of episode. But there's also a lot of character subplot type stuff that's definitely carrying over from episode to episode, such that if we had missed the first episode and came in at the second, we'd be like, well, you know, something's going on here, and clearly these characters have a history, but I wonder what it is. Because it's expected that we knew it from the first episode.
Well, yeah, and yeah. I got a friend of mine who's currently rewatching the show Bones.
Mm-hmm.
A show I watched from its inception through its finale. The really weird part is I missed two or three episodes at the end of one season. It was an early season, like third or fourth season. I missed the last, and she asked me some questions when she, and it's the episode where Zach kind of goes bad and has to be, it's that story.
Mm-hmm.
And those are like the four episodes I never watched. And it is amazing, because I remember coming back the next year at the season premiere. It is amazing how, in some ways, I felt slightly lost, even though I enjoyed that show, because those three or four episodes I missed and never saw.
I think part of this is a generational aspect. My parents' generation was such that TV was literally episodic. They could show the reruns in any order. It really wouldn't phase you. They may have been new to you because you watched something else, you know, that when it first aired. But now TV is got enough of those subplots, enough of those things that when my parents would go travel for a little bit and come back, and having missed those couple of episodes, at times they would complain because it's like they're watching a different show now. Nothing's the same. What happened to so-and-so? What's going on with this? And in some cases, when my sister and I are watching TV these days, it's like, you know, we went a whole episode and this character like totally vanished. Or here's the episode in which somebody decided they're writing this character out. Poof, they're gone. They're never going to be heard from again.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that sort of a thing, again, in comics, it's a serial narrative. And even, I mean, there are a handful I could point to that have done-in-one stories. Scooby-Doo team-ups, probably the best example I can come with. And even then, sometimes there's references that are, you know, that don't hurt the accessibility of, yeah, well, we met this character way back when.
Yeah.
You know, so there is a sense of history there. But you look at stories from, like, the next generation of Star Trek on TV, where there would be plots that would be called back and whatnot, but each episode stood on its own, but there was a clear order of them, but not a, you've got to go watch them all to have any idea what's going on, versus a modern day show where you're watching, again, chapters of a book for the season.
And again, I guess my real question, it kind of is what it is. I guess it's a chicken or the egg thing. Did stories change because somehow naturally that's what people wanted, or did the easily archivable just lead to that?
I think the archivable came afterwards and minimized the damage, but I think it was as our generation was coming up wanting more sophisticated stories than the Dunham one that they started to tell them.
But where do you see that? Because I'm trying to think, again, comics, my mind isn't there, but I'm trying to figure out where that happened. And it seems to have happened somewhere in the mid to late 1980s.
After the 80s, mid to late 80s at the earliest, absolutely.
So again, you're talking VCRs became ubiquitous.
There was the opportunity to do it, but it was not at the point it is now.
Oh, no, certainly wasn't at the point. But it was, you know, again, you talk about your parents would go on vacation, you just missed the show. By the late 80s, if you went on vacation for a week or were out, you know, had an event one night, you just taped it and watched it the next day.
That was an option, but not everybody did that.
I'd say it was more common. It was certainly not uncommon.
It was not uncommon, and it became increasingly common as time went on, to the point that it became uncommon because there was no longer the need to do it because of streaming services, because of Netflix and things of
exactly.
that sort, and DVDs.
Same thing. Books. You had the Barnes and Nobles, the Borders, the giant big box stores that had cheap paperbacks of the whole series always there. You weren't going to the small little bookstore that had this week's releases and, you know, what was hot, you know, the bestsellers for this month and what the patron had managed to cobble together. You know what I mean?
Well, the other difference is the internet and the ubiquitousness of availability. We could go to almost any one of these items on the top 500, barring a Batman or Superman, one of the things that goes back to like the dawn of comic book
sure.
time. And we could probably, without too much trouble, get a reprint or, you know, collected edition or something that got us caught up on the storyline for most of these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I'm saying. And it kind of somewhere in that late 80s through 2000 era, that kind of became prevalent for all the media we're talking about.
I guess my point is it became possible for all of it, but now it's gotten to the point where it's so trivial to take advantage of it. Because there was a point where they would start releasing DVD box sets. Every comic would get collected in trade or become on digital or whatever.
Yep.
But it went from happening to, well, I still can't find that DVD set or I can't find that trade or whatever, to name it, I can probably either digitally or, you know, physically pick up the full history of whatever. You know, you want the whole run of Hogan's Heroes, just hop on Amazon or wherever and order it, or go see if it's on whatever streaming service.
Yeah.
You know, you want to go catch up on the entire run of Walking Dead or Oblivion Song or whatever, it's a few clicks away.
Yeah.
And that makes the content accessible while simultaneously making the story inaccessible in the current installments, because there's the expectation that you would take advantage of the accessibility of the previous stories or the availability
yeah.
of them.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things I've been thinking about. I'm like, I wonder if all this easily at your fingertips archives has caused some of at least the things I perceive as problems in comics and many other media as well.
I definitely think it has, because since it's available, why haven't you read this? Why don't you know this?
Yeah.
You know, that's why people, it's like, don't feel spoilers are a big deal. Because, well, I mean, you can go find whatever you want. Yes, I don't have time to watch it or read it. You know,
yeah.
it's a really odd position we're in, that so much content is so readily available if you've got the time, the money, and the interest. Yet, comics, I think, were more accessible when they would, in the story itself, give you the recap you needed, or, you know, in the TV show or whatever, do the callbacks there, versus just assuming, well, you've watched every episode of Dukes of Hazzard or Gilligan's Island or whatever. And in those cases, you didn't need to. It wasn't relevant.
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing that's weird. And this is something I notice as we go through, like, the DC shows on the CW, and the person I watch those with is a tax accountant. Mm-hmm. So this is the part of the year where those are just going to stack up until after that season, and then we'll get through all of them after that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. They were available the other night, and we watched a random episode of one of those shows. And it was interesting. We used to get, when there was kind of those two-part television series, you'd get those previously on, and it was literally highlights from the last episode.
Yeah.
Now you get the previously on. I was thinking, I hadn't And it's highlights from an episode 9 episodes ago that you had forgotten about. And you go, oh, that's going to become relevant again in this episode, obviously.
Yes, yes. There's that. And there's also the clips that never aired.
Well, yeah, that too.
Those always annoy me. I'm waiting.
I always assume that's my faulty memory. I'm not sure enough of my memory to assume. Like, I don't think I've seen that, but I'm just going to assume I forgot it.
Oh, no. There are times where I know it's not my faulty memory because my sister and I had literally just finished the previous episode.
Yeah.
And I'm like, who's that guy? When did that happen? It's like I could piece together what they were trying to imply happened or whatever, but it's like, you didn't show me that last time. I'm waiting for somebody, and it almost seems like an Image book waiting to happen, where it starts with a previously on, and for like the first issue. And then it just like jumps forward a year in the next issue with a previously on, the kind of, well, we're glossing over this, we're getting to this. And just telling the juicy parts of the story they want to tell, and just, here's the core dump of everything else.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned on one of the recent Weekly Comic Spotlights that I listened to, I believe you said there was a web comic at some point that was kind of satire of comics called Gutters or something?
The Gutters. It was a web comic, yeah. And I checked. They've been out off since like 2014, maybe.
Anyways, and for those of us that are even older, you remember in Cerebus, Dave Sims, the Roach character, was basically a satirical poke at whatever was the hot thing in mainstream comics at the time.
I've never actually read Cerebus.
Okay, well, there is a reoccurring character who shows up, and he's sort of Batman sometimes, he's sort of Wolverine sometimes. The point is, he again, skewers kind of the comic industry of the time. You're right, though. Someplace like someone like Image or a publisher, a more independent, has got to take a chance on some kind of a satirical look at the comic industry, you'd think.
Absolutely.
There's got to be some hilarious stuff there.
There's tons of opportunity. And there have been some good, you know, single-page comic strips or whatever, be it The Gutters that was online and been collected into hardcovers, the Bumpkin Buzz stuff that was in Comic Buyer's Guide back in the day, the Fred Hembeck stuff, also in Comic Buyer's Guide, among other places back in the day. There's just a lot of things that we all just mock anyways that I'm surprised it isn't done more often in a comic style.
Yeah.
So.
Back to the list. I am scrolling through. I noticed one thing, and I just want to see. Rank 259, you highlighted Live Wire number 2 by Valiant. I'm pretty sure I know why, but why don't you go into it?
Well, this is a mini-series focusing on one of the characters after the crossover they'd done. And it sold 6,351 units, and that's down 76.36% from the previous issue, the first issue. That is a harsh second issue drop.
Well, the drop is over 3 times the sales.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it's over 75%. It lost 20,000 issues and only sold 6.
It's, I think, Valiant does good books. They do great books. They do lousy pacing of when they release the books. Because this is picking up from whichever crossover arc they'd done, and I've already forgotten what it was called. But even that was, they've got probably twice as many properties and titles as they're able to put out. So they'll put one or two on hiatus for, you know, 6 months to a year. They'll go through another one, put it on hiatus, go back to the first property and stuff like that. And you wind up with almost a staccato storytelling style. You know, fits and spurts.
And what's really odd, you don't have to go that much farther down the list to rank 279, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Where you find Valiant's biggest book from last month, Bloodshot Rising Spirit number 1, you've got reorder activity of that book that did almost as much as Livewire at $54.93.
Yeah.
And I noticed you highlighted Freeze number 2 by Image Comics, I'm assuming for a similar reason.
Exactly. At these another harsh drop. I read the first issue of this because it sounded interesting, thinking, I'm curious, but I'm probably not going to stick with it. I actually really enjoyed the book.
Okay, cool.
It's doing some interesting stuff. And then to see, it's like, okay, second issue, it lost over half its sales.
Yeah, and another Image title a few ranks above that at rank 281 that wasn't highlighted, Self-Made number 2. Again, I know nothing about it. But yeah, the second issue, 54.36 down 51% from over 11,000 last month.
There's a lot of cases where we have just some hideously sharp drop-offs.
Yeah.
And some of them are to be expected on the second issue or second issue equivalent. If we go up to rank 228, we've got Archie 701, which is kind of sort of a you know, second issue drop or whatever after 700. It's down over 60%.
Well, but again, it's, and maybe it's just the scale thing. When we see it, because we talked about this at the beginning of this very episode, when you see it on the Marvel book where they figure out a way to make a book sell 280,000, you know, okay, it's going to go back to, it's going to go down three quarters and it'll be at 60,000. But when you're starting at 10,000 and you still get those kind of drops, that's kind of scary.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Freeze for a minute. If we go and look at how much money at retail value that brought in, that's, let's see, scroll over to the right, I've got it. It's like $20,740.02 full retail value for those issues, okay, or those copies of that issue, I should say. Got to take out of that the percentage that the publisher doesn't get because it goes to the discounting for the retailer and the distributor. Take out of what they've got the cost of printing, the cost of actually creating the content, and oh wait, it's an Image Central book, I believe, $2,500 trafficking cost. Are they going to make the money on this? Now, maybe they can, maybe they won't, but this is the second issue, and it's down to under 5,200 units.
Well, even the first issue, 10,857, right?
Mm-hmm.
At 399, for call that 40,000, right?
Sure.
40,000 at full resale. Okay. Figure retailers on average will go to Keystone, give them 50%. So now you're down to 20,000 to the distributor. Figure you're going to get another 10% gross margin to your distributor. You're down to 3,600. I'm sorry. Yeah. What are no. 40, 20, no, 20. You're down to 18,000.
Yeah, at least.
18,000. Now you're talking 22 to Image, or 17 or 16.5.
Mm-hmm.
Now you figure you got to print 10,000. I mean, printing 10,000 comic books can't be completely free.
Agreed.
You know, figure, I don't know, maybe that's a couple $1,000.
I'd have to look at some of the last numbers I saw for printing. But yeah, it eats into it. Plus, there's the shipping or whatever, I believe you may or may not have to pay. Retailers pay for some of it. I don't know if the publisher has to get it to Diamond or not. And depending, it may be part of the printing cost. Either way, there's still the cost to write, draw, letter, color, etc. the book. At that point, they're making money on that first issue. Maybe not tons, but now when you start cutting those sales in half, the fixed costs on the content creation don't change. The percentages going to the distributor and the retailer don't change. The shipping gets lower. The printing gets lower per unit. Or let me rephrase. It's a higher per unit cost because you're printing less, but it's a lower cost. It's just distributed over fewer units. So there quickly comes a point, and it comes down to how much do they need to make, how much are they expecting to have this almost as that loss leader we talked about last month to get that trade and make the money there.
Yeah.
And it to me, begs the question of how much is that Image I worth? And I do think it is worth something. Premier placement in the front of the Diamond catalog, I think, is worth a lot. I still believe in the theory of pre-order fatigue, if you will, where the later in previews you are, the less you would sell. I got nothing to prove that, but it logically holds water.
Yeah, well, and again, and this goes back a few years. I remember Jim Zub wrote a breakdown, kind of how much it costs him to do small print runs.
Yeah.
And he said for a $3.99 book, if he makes 80 cents an issue, he's doing pretty well. And again, you're talking 80 cents on, you know, what, 5,100, 5,200 issues?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. That's $4,000 basically. And if you're splitting that with two creators, you got a writer and an artist, let alone letterers, inkers, you know, you split that three, four ways.
Yeah, you start to
hard to make a living.
Exactly. That's why we start to see some of these creators, particularly on the writers, doing multiple books, etc. That's why we see the artist hanging on to the original art, selling it at conventions, doing sketches and stuff there.
Yeah.
That's why we see these things getting optioned for TV and movie. That's where the money is. I think it's great for the people to be able to do the comics this way. I think it's a good way to grow and develop intellectual property, but you've got to have something that keeps people coming back.
Yeah.
And when I see things launching, like Peter Cannon at rank 261 with 6,226 units, it's probably going to lose ground on the next issue because, well, everything does. You know, we may not see that next one in the top 300. Now, we've got the top 500 these months, so we'd see where it fell to, but still, not good. It's a rough market. And when we've got things that are time-tested properties, like Star Trek, like Power Rangers, which has a large fan base and it's been going 25-plus years, it's only got such a foothold in the market. Even longer-term properties, you know, like, oh, Superman and the X-Men and the Avengers and stuff like that, aren't always doing brilliantly.
Yeah, it is. You know, I said, hopefully there's a way these creators are figuring out a way to do what they love and make a living doing it. But it's hard to believe there's much of a real full-time job in creating small comics.
But people manage to do it. I'd love to see how they work the numbers and stuff like that. I'm hoping a lot of them are having the success and whatnot they want to have and that they're enjoying the process. But it goes back to, you want to make a little money in comics, best way to do it is start with a lot of money.
Yeah.
It just seems it's way easier to lose money than make it. And I know there are people making it because they're still doing it. And in many cases, they're doing good work. And that certainly helps a lot.
Well, again, I wonder how much those conventions, I wonder if it wasn't for, you know, because seemingly the convention circuit is very robust and doing very well. It would be interesting to see if it wasn't, you know, how if you could actually make a living doing this just off selling the books.
I think it comes down to the nature of the individual. I think some people, if they weren't spending their time at the conventions, would have the knowledge and the talent to actually do the hustling they would need to sell the books and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But don't have the time because they're at the conventions building up the fan base or whatever. There are other people where they just don't have those kinds of skills of self-promotion and stuff like that, that it might be harder.
Yeah.
Don't know. If we look at the price points, 80-plus percent of the items in the top 300 are at $3.99, and above that we've got, what?
12.67%.
Yeah, not a whole lot.
Still over 10%.
Yeah, well, twice over it than below it.
Exactly.
So, majority of the issues are got issue numbers between 1 and 12.
Yep.
Not surprising, even after the legacy numbering at Marvel, that came and went pretty quickly. So anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
I'm good.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themayoreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If you differ from your reality, please verify that you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there is at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or as few as 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future.
no visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions. They're not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists. It included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside of Diamond Comics distribution channels included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Ath Logic and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.